Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Initech.
No, you're working at Initech because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world, and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Oh, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke. Don't do
If I had $1 million.
Hello and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Andrew on the board. We have S&P futures up 42, NASDAQ futures up 197. So we go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth on every word out of the mouthpiece. Yesterday had to do with cooking oil. In the afternoon, it sent the S&P or the NASDAQ down 200 points. If the Chinese aren't buying our soybeans, we're not going to buy their cooking oil. We can make our own cooking oil. I'm going to say we could probably make cooking oil from the soybeans they're not buying. Just saying. Anyway, Kevin, sorry we're late. It was a semi versus wall downtown, and we
I fought the wall and the wall run.
Well, the semi's probably not having a good day, but we managed to screw it up. We got to the Grand Avenue exit, and I said, should we get off here? And we put our faith in the system, and we ended up getting off at Ohio, and Ohio has construction on there. The middle lane... They're doing something with the middle lane, so you got to split. But there's, of course, no workers, no equipment there, so I don't know what in God's name they're doing. But that's the construction these days. It's because there's barriers. Doesn't mean they're doing anything. So then you got to go up Wells Street, which every light's a... It's time, so you hit every light, and there's a light every block. So that's always nice as well. So there you go. So did you... are you getting these texts from the White House on these trades? 200 points here, 400 points there, 800 points there? I mean, these... It's kind of fun if you're involved in it, I think. Just saying.
Oh, it probably is if anybody's if they're actually getting those. So yeah, I would say so.
But if they're not,
I'm not getting any texts. And if I'm not getting them, Tom, they're probably not going out.
That's what I was thinking too. Well, that makes sense too. Hey, you know, I got a question for you, and I should have texted you if I was a better human being and asked you this one. But we had a contributor in the other day, actually stopped by and was saying something about there's a deal floating around. We've heard, you and I have talked about from time to time, private equity getting involved in some of the schools, right? And I don't know, has that happened yet? Has anybody sold?
It seems to me it has on an individual school level, and I can't tell you which one it is, so I'm thinking yes, but I can't cite which one, so we'd have to work on that. But you're talking about the Big Ten raising it for the whole conference, and getting a big pay-in that they can use. And I don't know how they plan to use it. It has to be more than promotion to the conference, I'm sure. But for conference operations to make it a huge professional league success.
Well, questions is my gift and my sin is always what exactly is the Big Ten? The profit centers are the school, right? The schools, and I'm thinking they contribute something to the Big Ten for the lavish offices and I'm sure way too high salaries. Is it a trade association? I mean, how can they sell anything? I mean, are they a trade association? Are they a corp? What do you think they are?
There's voluntary. No, actually, I was going to say there's voluntary membership, but once you sign on, they aren't totally a trade association. Think of it as the media rights that they get.
I'm talking about the.
I know, but
the Big Ten itself, that little unit. I'm talking
right.
About the people.
They can't just be a trade association if they're accepting payment for media rights and distributing them among the schools, can they?
That's my question to you. I mean, are they...
Is it a corporation? Is it a a partnership among the member schools, that the legal construct, don't know. You should put Lou on that today so that he's going to go with it tomorrow.
Well,
the reason why I ask
is that the Chicago Board Options Exchange, back when they were, in my opinion, a real place where people traded, the members, it was actually set up under Delaware law, same as a country club, which means that if you and I join a country club, we actually are an equity member. Our membership is the share of stock. Well, it's not a share of stock, but that's our membership is the, if there's 500 members of Beverly Country Club, those 500 members all have an equity share in Beverly Country Club. And at the CBOE, anybody who owned a seat was an equity member of the seat. And it was very complicated because the Board of Trade essentially formed the CBOE and sold seat rights, and every Board of Trade member seat was able to go trade on the Board of Trade. And I'm not sure that they had 100% equity rights, but they had trading rights. And then when the CBOE went public, I'm not sure if they had a... Boy, I should know this. I don't know if they had to give those guys shares or not. I don't think they did. So I'm wondering if the... How many teams are in there? 18? If the 18 teams essentially are set up the same way. But I don't know that when Rutgers came in, Southern Cal came in, that they were going to get a full equity share like they had been there 100 years. I mean, I don't know if that would work for them. It worked for the exchange. It works for country clubs. But that's just another formation that sometimes people use for this sort of stuff that people maybe don't know about. I'm not saying that's what it is. I just wonder, maybe it is. I mean, it can't just be a corporation that somehow these guys... The schools must have to pay.
Here's what it is, so I can help you with that. So it is, and you're going to love the 501c3, not-for-profit. A charitable organization recognized by the IRS, and it's incorporated in the state of Illinois.
Illinois? I thought they were in Indiana, but they're incorporated in Illinois, huh?
NCAA is in Indianapolis. You drive by on 294 where the Big Ten offices are. That's Illinois.
Where's the Big Ten offices?
It's Des Plaines or thereabouts. You know,
okay, it's up
there.
North. Okay.
You drive by the tri-state, it's right there.
So they must get, the schools that evidently are allegedly non-profit, or churches, or what the hell they are. So they must contribute from their stuff to the Big Ten, who goes out and does this work for them. Does their advertising, does their negotiating, does that kind of stuff. It must be something like that, right?
Well, whether they contribute to it or... I mean, legally, I don't know how they operate the transactions. Practically, it's a pass-through.
Yeah. So the Big Ten sells a $2 billion deal. They take $50 million off the top for their outrageous expenses and split the rest up.
Something like that, yeah.
So how is it if they sell to a profit organization, they don't blow to the charitable organization?
That is an interesting question. What would happen? Let's take it out of the sports realm, because that's where the big profit is, and let's just say you have a 501c3 does some kind of advocacy for left-handed people who have male pattern baldness, and they get a private equity infusion into that organization. I suppose it depends on what the private equity infusion is. If it were a contribution, it would be no problem, correct? However, no private equity company is going to make a contribution here with no strings attached.
Yeah, what was... Boy,
so
Kevin.
They're looking to get something out of it, you know, like they'll probably get a board position, you know, or more. That, you know, there will be an agreement on how much of the Big Ten's revenue comes back to the investor. So I think that whole legal construct would have to change to pull this off.
Dr. Demiak thinks they're going to pull it off. I talked to her. That somehow they're going to stay that way. And I don't... But right now, if the all right, you and I are we're flaring this up, and I think we're getting close, Kevin. If they
flaring it up, but we're speculating too.
Okay, so. But if they get right now, let's say they get a $2 billion deal with ESPN or somebody, they take their expenses, which you and I might say are high, or maybe they're not, and they split the rest up among the however many teams are in the Big Ten. Well, now if a private equity firm piles in into $2 billion and say they bought 20% of the Big Ten, do they get $400 million off the top before it's... So now the Big Ten itself has to become some sort of a profit center.
Well, yeah, but they would not get the $400 million off the top because no investor gets off the top of revenue. You get it off of the profits.
But how do you know what the profits are?
So it still holds up with what you're saying. It has to be a profit center of some type. It has to have profit accounting. But not for profit doesn't necessarily mean there's no profit. 501c3s turn a profit all the time. They just they don't necessarily distribute the profits. And I'm sure the Big Ten could probably arrange for some kind of distribution that keeps their profit levels within whatever guidelines they do before the IRS says no.
See, the again, I'll go back to the CBOE model. What they did is they were not for profit as well. Okay, with this, just but if they actually made a profit, they had to pay taxes. So what would happen is if you get to like October and they were, and the way their budget was, they're supposed to make, they always wanted $100 million, or they wanted to make it $100 million in equity, so in case there was ever a problem or you had to do any kind of a real quick work on the floor or something, they wanted that as a buffer. Okay, so
you want a rainy day fund is what you're saying.
But so if all of a sudden they were running over that, they would say to all the members, okay, instead of the fees being 20 cents a contract or for the last 3 months of the year, we're going to make them 10 cents a contract. And if they were all over that, maybe the last 2 weeks of December, they didn't charge. So they would manage the fees coming in from the members to where they were only going to pay taxes on the $5 million they wanted to make that year, and they weren't going to pay taxes on 10. So I wonder, in what would these guys cut be? You know, if the money comes into the... Now it appears to be a total pass through on the money, but if it's not, how do you not pay at that level?
Unless you have the same kind of setup where the conference is the bargaining agent, but ultimately it's a series of individual deals for actually how the equity gets invested in the schools.
See, I'm all for at this point.
You know, I'm just I'm speculating, yeah. But I'm just like, okay, how would they get around this without doing?
Well, that's what we're doing. We're trying to figure. But I guess you could pass the advertising money all the way through, and then just up the fees that the schools have to pay to the Big Ten, and those guys get a chunk of those fees. You could probably go that way. But even then, now it becomes a profit organization. How do you pay? How does a 403C or whatever, how do they pay dividends? They don't, do they?
Not that I know of. I've never known one to do that.
Anyway,
most
Kevin.
Most of them exist to pay exorbitant salaries to the CEO and the senior.
Well, staff. I would, I much as we still try and love our alma mater, I would have zero problem with the state of Indiana saying, you know what? We got a 10% amusement tax, and this looks to me like we're a long way from Sacred Heart Church when you put 80,000 people in the stadium. We want our amusement tax. I think we're there, Kevin. But if we have any of our friends listening, they're ready to shoot me. But I think we're there.
Well, I wonder if they're baked into the if amusement tax is baked into the ticket price already.
I'm gonna say I'll take the under in that. I don't think Northwestern pays it. I don't think any Illinois pays it. Illinois has got an unusual relationship with the state anyway, but still, this is not school, is it?
No, college football hasn't had much to do with college for a long time.
Yeah, well, it's and they're going as far as away as they possibly can at this point. What do you think the sort of on the same note, we've been going back and forth about the guy at Penn State's buyout club. Kevin, what do you think happened there? I have a feeling when the book is written, I was just speculating last night with my attorney buddies. I go, you know, something's wrong here. We're talking about the number two team in the country that has an issue. They lost, I don't know who the first game they lost to was somebody decent, right? Then they lost to UCLA out there. Then they lose to Northwestern. I have a feeling that somewhere buried in the bowels of this mess, there is four or five key players that somehow their deal went sour on them, or somebody's supposed to pay them, wasn't paying them. Something happened there other than just the coach calling the wrong plays. I mean, am I totally wet here or what?
Ask that again.
I'm saying something happened here other than the coach all of a sudden being an idiot and calling the wrong play. Somehow somebody didn't get paid, or some deals were reneged on. There's some sort of upheaval on that team. There has to be.
Well, there could be. It can be pretty simple and straightforward that you go and you lose a couple games in a row and people start blaming each other. It could be that there were divisions on the team in the first place. I mean, really, team cohesiveness, especially with that many people, is very, very difficult to maintain. So there's always going to be factions. And, you know, and everybody gets an audience. So, you know, everybody's got their friends. If you can keep everybody focused, and that is sort of the genius of being a head coach, especially in pro sports, if you can keep everybody focused and moving in one direction, even if they have their individual interests, then, you know, that's the magic. You know, Phil Jackson was never a great tactician. He hired people who could be good tacticians, but he wasn't. His genius was that he could get people focused on the end game, on winning the winning championships. And you really saw that. I mean, you saw it a lot in Chicago, where he had an incredible group of head cases. But you saw it even more in Los Angeles with the Lakers, because he left them for a while, if you remember. He decided he was to retire. And then all of a sudden, the Lakers weren't the Lakers anymore. And then they persuaded him to come back. And then all of a sudden, the Lakers were the Lakers again. You know, it really is about managing the egos. And you have a team full of people who have big egos. That's a big part of why they're successful athletes. But they've also had their butts kissed for a long, long time because they are great athletes. And now all of a sudden they're not getting it so much. So I think it could be as simple as Franklin's leadership skills for those kinds of things weren't great or were substandard. And it could be, like you said, that some people didn't get paid what they were promised, or, you know, that you started to get some toxic things like that. And then we saw some, you know, some toxic issues with the Notre Dame women's basketball game that came to fore last spring that divided that team. So, and those were all personal issues. So you just don't know.
You know, it's funny, Kevin. Last year when we were, not to dig into that, but I don't have a, well, I like watching them. I'm not going to just say that I don't. The day the attitude changed, I picked it up on the floor right away.
Yeah, you picked it up faster than I did.
Yeah, I mean, I don't, maybe because...
Although I still say, make a few more outside shots, because they all, it was like the Cubs batting this summer. When everybody's in a shooting slump, you're going to lose some games.
What do you do on these teams? I mean, we'll go back to the, and you know more about this than me, maybe you can explain it. When the SMU situation, when they totally fell apart and they got the damn near the death penalty, that was a while ago, wasn't it an individual people on the team essentially squealing other people on the team?
Yeah, I think there were a lot of jealousies that were involved in there.
No,
been a long time since I've seen that 30 for 30, but the 30 for 30 about the Pony Express was really good.
But what do you do now? Let's say Freeman, so far, he's young and, you know, he's young, he's energetic, people seem to like him. What do you do if you hook up all your high school guys and somehow or another you get them paid by this guy and that guy, and everybody's somewhat happy, and all of a sudden You get a guy like Hartman comes flying through the portal, and now he's your quarterback, and he's making $1 million from he was Under Armour, right? And they're giving him that kind of money. Well, you know, I never saw the guy in a commercial, so I'm assuming they gave him the money just so he could go to Notre Dame, but that, you know, that's a stretch. He's not like, he's on an Under Armour commercial. He's really good. I mean, I never saw him. Maybe he was somewhere, but so all of a sudden.
Or think Caleb Williams doing Dr. Pepper for USC.
Well, so that.
And they did bring him in from Oklahoma, so yeah, there you go.
But I'm saying all of a sudden now, you were the second string quarterback, and guess what? It's obvious to everybody that you're better than Hartman. Now, Freeman, who, you know, appears to be the cream of the crop here in terms of personality, what happens if he plays you instead of him in terms of the relationship with Under Armour? What happens if he doesn't play you instead of him? Or if you do get paid and he's making $1 million to sit on his ass on the bench and you're making 48 cents to play, I got to believe in the 18 to 21-year-old age group or in any age group, that is a bomb in church.
It really is difficult. And I'll give you the better example is last year with Riley Leonard coming in, because Steve Angeli was the backup who would have been in line to be the starter. And Angeli, who's now at Syracuse, but Angeli was really the good soldier all the way through. And every time they needed him to play, he played really well, including in the playoff game against Penn State when Leonard got knocked out of the game late in the first half, and Angeli led him on a drive that kept them in the game when Penn State was threatening to move away from him at that point. And then Leonard came back in for the second half, and they won the game. But those are the kinds of things. If you don't think that Angeli had supporters on the team, that he had friends after in his third year there, and that they were disappointed at him not playing, that's a hard situation to manage, and Freeman did it well. But a lot of credit to Angeli too, because Angeli didn't make any trouble out of it. He played good soldier, he got his degree, he transferred and he became the starter at Syracuse, and I'm not sure if he's back. He had an injury
an injury. But here's the thing, Kevin, I almost got the feeling, and maybe honestly I'm gonna say I'm not as close to it as you guys are. In terms of, I still care, but I don't care as much as you guys do. I honestly got the feeling that they really didn't want Angeli to show too much.
They had C.J. Carr waiting in the wings, and they didn't want to create this incumbency issue.
Yeah, but almost like you don't want the guy to be too good because you're paying the other guy more. I mean, you don't really see
I've had situations, let me give you, take it completely out of sports and give you a different situation. I have had people who, I think of one situation when I was in Milwaukee and I took over an IT group where every employee thought he or she was on a track to be a network engineer. And I only needed a couple of network engineers. And so, I had to sit down one-on-one with each of them and say, I don't have a slot for you. I may in the future. I will be happy to work with you to develop. And I said, if you get to the point where you're ready to make that move and I can't accommodate you, come to me and I will help you land your next job. And that may have been part of the conversation, especially at the end of the year with Angeli, although he did come back for spring football to compete for the job. The conversation could easily go you will compete for the job in the spring, and if you win it, you'll get it. But if you don't, I'm going to help you get placed in a good situation. I think, how you treat people like that is really of critical importance. And that's part of the way you keep harmony, is you make people think that they're being treated, if not fairly well, they're being treated well. And can you imagine Brian Kelly treating people well like that?
My quick Brian Kelly story. We weren't on yesterday with my buddy who runs the Buckingham, African American guy. He's a terrific dude. He runs a club and he went to LSU. And he and I get along great. He still has his edge though, that I gave him Kelly. So he has a little bit of a problem. But not a Notre Dame fan, because we have Kelly because Notre Dame didn't want him anymore.
they certainly weren't willing to fight to keep him.
Yeah, so he goes, he says, first thing about the Penn State deal, he goes, hey, I heard Penn State is looking at Kelly. I'll buy his airplane ticket. So I'll pay for his ticket. Please take him. So there, I don't think...
Algon, take him away. Yeah, and look, the way this manifests itself, and this is a comment from Freeman in his post-game press conference, so you know he's speaking off the cuff and just taking questions as they come in. And they were talking about improvement, because they have been step-by-step improving. Just, it's the commitment to what we're asking our guys to do, the sacrifice they're making, the choice they have to make every single Saturday to put team before me, and the choice they have to make Monday through Friday to say, I have to elevate as an individual. I have to get better. If they continue to do that, they'll understand that we have room to grow. That, you know, that is kind of an approach, and obviously if he can rattle that off extemporaneously, it's really part of his approach to coaching, to being a head coach and to coaching football. It's a really positive approach to how you manage the improvement process. And if you do that with every single player, and then say, because Notre Dame's got a lot of players who are starting elsewhere that, you know, played under Freeman the last couple of years, and that they've moved along. If you do that, and then you take care of people on the way out the door, then I think you're more likely to be okay. It doesn't mean it can't blow up on you, but it means you're more likely to be okay. You know, another good one, this is sort of tangentially related, but I'm trying to remember the exact quote from Ben Johnson after the game in the locker room on Monday, where he was talking about all the penalties they had. And in his words, in his own words, but he said something to the effect of, imagine how good we're going to be when we clean that up.
Well, now, I'll say
where I'm going with that is, it's a different way of thinking about how you lead people. You could get there, you could talk to them and say, you know, you assholes have to clean that shit up.
Well, yeah. Well, you know, I on the one hand...
And you can do that all week if you need to. But it is really a matter of, you know, you have to be looking at, for the individuals and for your group, what's the future state that you're trying to achieve? This is what leadership is about. What are you trying to become? And keeping focused on the what you're trying to become, so that everything that you do along that way moves you a little closer to it. And you have to very obviously explain to people how this next step is moving us a little closer to it.
My views on Freeman are positive just about totally, except there's always an except, Kevin. I wonder if he... I keep thinking of the... I don't know why I watched that stupid show. One day I did, but it reminds me of a Boardwalk Empire. You can't be half a gangster, Nucky, when he didn't want to take the envelope. I wonder how long Freeman and the Notre Dame alumni, of which we have a bunch of goofballs, our best friends, goofballs, which we all are, how much are we going to realize that we still think we're morally above just about everybody else? I don't know how long that can last. I really don't.
And Freeman has definitely cut loose on some guys, especially early on, almost pushed them out the door. He's a football coach. He's a head football coach at a major college program. He is going to be a very tough individual, even though he's likable, actually.
But I'm saying likeable. We still think we're still mostly the old way. You ever read a book, boy?
Yeah, I don't know a lot of people that think that, including most of our friends.
Well, we still like the idea that we're recruiting in high school and we get, you know, those kind of people. One thing I'm getting to, Kevin, you ever read a book, I forget the guy who wrote it, called Up the Organization?
Yeah, I remember it.
Wasn't he the head of Avis? And then when they sold out to the corporation about all the stuff the corporation made him, he couldn't wait to get out of there. And one of his chapters was on salaries or something. And he said, you don't want to make a practice of putting a list by the coffee machine or the can what everybody in the company makes. He said, you don't really want to make a practice of that. But if somebody stole it out of your desk and stuck it up there, you should never be embarrassed by it either. I have a feeling that in just about all these colleges now, after, you know, the years, and some people play hurt, some people don't, somebody gets better during the year, somebody's starting, somebody isn't. If you, in week 10, put a list of every dime these guys are making. Now, I'll take the guys that are actually making the commercials and are talented and don't spend the time. I put them in a separate class. I put, what's her name, the young lady at Notre Dame who got the Red Bull, where she makes the commercials and she's adorable. I have to take that out because that has nothing to do really with basketball. She'd be a star even if she wasn't a basketball player, I think. But if you put that up in any of these locker rooms, it has to be a total abortion in terms of who's making what and who's playing what and who's playing better. When you got 85 people in that room, I don't see how anybody could defend it, really, even Freeman. I mean, but he's, so far he's doing great. I'm just wondering, over the long pull, somewhere somebody's going to say, hey, I'm running 50 sprints a night, and I played 48 plays last week. The schlump in front of me that's making twice as much, every time he pulls a hangnail, he's out for 2 weeks, and I'm covering for him, and he's making 10 times I am. It has to come up somewhere, doesn't it?
They all know. They all know what each other are getting.
You think they do?
Oh, yeah.
How?
Because they talk.
All right, well, I mean...
If I don't talk to everybody, how many talk people? To you, Tom, and then you tell people.
Okay, but how many people do you have lunch with or I have a drink with that I know how much they make? Nobody. I don't ask anybody that.
Well, that's because we're from a generation where, that was considered tacky to ask.
Well, I mean... Okay, so Kevin was a tackle, by the way. So Kevin, the guy in front of you, Kevin, has a cramp or something, and he's out the whole game. You go in there and have a real big game, and all of a sudden you say to him, hey, Joe, by the way, you made 10 grand today. I made one. It looks to me like I did all the work. I mean, how far does that go?
Do you not doubt that happens in the corporate world all the time?
I think if people have an idea of what... I never knew what people made at Pullman, and I was pretty up the chain. I had an idea, but I didn't... You know what
people
this...
If they don't know the exact number, they know they have a pretty darn good idea of it. Kind of, you could always look at the car someone's driving.
You know what was weird about it, Kevin, is they had their salary. Did you ever run into this? You might be too young, even though you're a couple of years. You know what they would run into? They had all these salary ranges for, like, grade levels... And so if you were going to be a senior financial analyst, you're supposed to be making, 25 to 28 or something. I'll pick a number. That's, a long time ago. Well, if you got hired at 17 and all of a sudden they go, this guy's pretty damn good. Uh-oh, we have a 6% raise limit this year. Even though they gave you the new job, they didn't necessarily get you in the range. Back in those days, I mean, I don't know. Maybe you do now. I don't know, but I knew all kinds of people. The people I did know their salary. The guys that were moved up quicker, or they got hired at a lower number. That's why for years and years, I hope it's still not the same because we don't hire that many people. But that you really got paid based on your last job, not by what you did for the new people. Is that still rampant?
Yeah, isn't that exactly how we know pro sports to work? How many people are low draft picks, and they sort of live with their draft status, as they chase next contracts. That's been a phenomenon for a long time.
I wouldn't exactly call it a phenomenon, but a reality.
The reality is okay. It's a good word for it.
Yeah, it seems like. So I don't know. I wish these guys had a little bit more of an idea where this is all going to land before they just get there rapidly.
Yeah, but they don't. They don't know. They're going from day to day, week to week. There doesn't appear to be any real strategy for it.
All right. So let me throw a couple of variables at you, and then you describe the world going forward from there, if you can.
I'm sorry. Say that again.
I said I'm going to lob a couple of variables at you, and you let's say This is even more than it is now. This college ball becomes more of a professional thing. And all of a sudden, either the Big Ten or a judge or somebody says, hey, as long as somebody's in college, they can play. None of this four-year bullshit where, with an extra year if you're hurt. You can play 6 years or seven or whatever you want to play. What makes you think that we're gonna get people that just go to school... You go to grad school, if they want to. They go to law school, that's 7 years. They play ball for 6-7 years. make a bunch of dough, become an attorney, become a doctor, and just say screw pro ball. It's just a lower level pro ball, which isn't really lower level because you got more people there. Because people still think it's part of the school. You think that's where we land? I think it might be.
You've speculated about that before. I think that's a little less likely. I think it's more likely. Now, maybe it will be, but I think I think the next thing that's going to happen is that somebody's going to figure out that these are really employees of the school. They're not student athletes. It's not an extracurricular activity. And that's going to show up legal. Somebody's going to do a comp claim or something like that after an injury. And then that's when they're going to have to deal with the notion that these are really employees. They have to start treating them like that. And it actually, just from the pure sports standpoint, forget whether it has anything to do with school or not, then you can start putting people under contract. And once somebody's under contract, then if you signed a 2-year contract or a 3-year contract, whatever they're willing to commit to you, then you're not going to up and transfer every year. So that could probably bring some order, get back into what's really a chaotic setup right now as far as managing rosters. So I could really envision that happening. Now, when it does, then they'll start saying, okay, well, why can't I sign a guy who's in graduate school just because he only played 4 years? Then I think that discussion will come along, but I don't think that's going to be the one that drives it.
Well, what would stop, this may be more of a Lou question as well, what would stop next year, I'll just say the Irish do it, what would stop them going to Kevin's son in high school and saying, guess what, here's the deal, it's a pretty good school, tuition's pretty damn good here, pretty expensive. We like you. We don't really renege on people that stay and don't grow or get hurt. And guess what? You're not going to renege on us either. So what we signed, we're going to promise you 3 years of tuition. You're going to promise us 3 years here. And if somebody grabs you before then, they better repay us the 2 years tuition that we paid before you were ready to play, because now you're ready. Why can't the Irish do that tomorrow?
Nobody wants to be the first, because what you're doing is you're tying up players and you're telling everybody else, hey, they're killing your options for you. We won't do that to you. So nobody wants to be out first doing it, because then they would be at a disadvantage when it comes to recruiting players.
I would say that...
They have a more restrictive arrangement.
Okay. It is a little more restrictive, but it's also... I think the parents might go for it. Well, how many people do you think pile into the portal every year and just blow their scholarship? Nobody picks them up.
Well, there's a fair number of those.
Can you imagine if that was your kid? You'd want to kill him. You go home to Pops and say, next year you got to write the $70,000 check? That's got to be an interesting conversation.
Yeah, well, you're staying home and going to a local school.
Yeah, so I mean, it's a...
conversation goes.
What do you... All right, so we've got, what do you make of what we go through Vomortis on Friday, but the markets the last few days, what's your impression on the up, down, all over the place, and his gold is to the moon. Now, Powell comes out and says he's not going to, they're gonna lower the balance sheet. And for those, I don't want to go into this, I talk too much about this because nobody wants to hear it probably, but when you say... They're lowering the balance sheet, which means stuff is coming off. The Fed is pulling money out of the system. So you might say to yourself, how the hell are they pulling money out of the system, yet the money supply is still going up? Well, because of the amount of credit that is piling in there and people borrowing, that increases the money supply on its own. So for the Fed to maintain it, they actually have to... They're not retarding it fast enough. Is really the reason why it's exploding to the upside. Now, Powell, which to me, all you got to look at him, he's a beaten man. He's talking about now lowering rates again, and they're going to stop the runoff of the balance sheet, which is essentially giving the okay to the current administration to balloon the money supply, like we've done for a while, only even more so, which benefits some people and not other people. And we've talked about that ad infinitum. How far can we go with that, Kevin, without... The inflation just, and if, what happens to this or any administration if they allow anybody to do it, if all of a sudden you get a 1.5% month increase like we used to get in the CPI, how does this all blow apart, or does it?
Well, I don't know. That's probably a better Russell question, and he's on. My take is right now the ups and downs of the market are partly tied to monetary policy, but they're also very tied to Chinese policy and trying to figure out what's going to happen next there.
Can you think of
trade policy?
Can you think of two countries? Well, we're not anywhere near as bad. Those guys, they're in pretty bad shape for all this brinkmanship, and we're not that far behind. It's like two guys fighting at the, I don't know, fighting for control of the Titanic if they're not careful. Just seems weird, doesn't it? I mean, they're siphoning off so much money over there towards defense.
Isn't that what happened with Russia during the 1980s?
Yeah.
What was the old joke at the time? Because Japan was thriving at the time, and so the Cold War is over, and Japan won.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, I don't see how. I really don't. Well, I'll ask Lou to do a little research on it because he still can listen to Russian TV. I have no idea how that guy stays in power with the incredible, I guess they still think that Ukraine is theirs and whatever, but I can't imagine the hit that Lou talked 2 years ago about how the trains are stopping on the tracks, and a lot of it's only one track train going all across, and because they can't get any roller bearings. How could that all have improved unless the Korea is making all this stuff for them, or China?
But it hasn't improved, and again, that's a Russell thing, and Russell, you can chime in on this, but it's definitely, you have to have strongman tactics. Even that might not be enough to work on your behalf sooner or later. The more you strong arm people, the more likely you are to get this most serious blowback. In other words, not dismissed, killed. So you have to deal with that possibility as well. In the meantime, he's sort of operating in Chuck Schumer mode. And what I mean by that is Schumer got a lot of crap last time they did a continuing resolution. It was earlier this year. And he got a lot of crap from the base for cooperating with Trump and almost got replaced as Speaker. Minority leader, so this time he's reacting, I think, as much to preserve his employment status by being an obstructionist as he is by being for any let's say good policy effect, because this whole shutdown thing does not have any good policy effect.
Well, it doesn't on either side.
It doesn't. But this is the same. Obviously, the argument is that this is the same continuing resolution they passed, like 13 times or something like that. So what's changed now is your big question.
Well, I think part of what's changed, and I don't know if anybody even knows, but the idea that the House guys aren't even in Washington is kind of weird.
They have no intent on figuring this thing out anytime in the near term.
Evidently not.
That's pretty obvious,
Well, Kevin, I'm not big on pictures, but Russell stopped by the other day. He was resplendent in a suit, a Trump tie. The dude could have been president.
Yeah, what, you have one of those? You have a solid red tie, Russell?
I had a solid red tie with skull and crossbones on it.
Oh, nice.
He stopped off with Dr. Demiak, who is every bit as nice in person as she is on the show. And I tell you what, I felt like I was with royalty. Kevin, two PhDers sitting with me talking, was pretty cool.
But you are not the smartest person in the room for sure, Chief.
No, well, when am I?
and neither was I at the moment. So no.
Anyway, she's very very impressive, and we actually have somebody. He is coming on today, right, Russell?
I brought. He's sitting on here now. And Kevin, if you want to make an exit or if you want to hang out, either way. But
I will make the exit.
Well,
we got that email about how poorly Bills fans are being treated, and I looked up the biggest diehard Bills fan that I know, who's actually been on the program before. I believe, Mike, you've been on with us before.
I have. It's great to be back.
Hi, Mike
and Dr. Rhodes.
Yeah, and you don't have to call me that. And you know, what's really funny is my I'm sitting here looking at Mary Beth, my wife, right now, and she's just cracking up when she heard me say that. She goes, "You don't have to call me that." She has no idea what you called me. But
it's probably better that way.
Before I go,
yes, Kevin.
I looked while we were talking. The colleges are subject to local amusement taxes.
Really?
Wow.
I can't believe that the Irish don't put that on the ticket.
Well, I don't know. They put it on an e-ticket?
Well, so it was never on the old tickets.
Scan it and get the terms?
Well, I mean,
doesn't tell you what it is?
I don't know what South Bend's amusement tax is, if anything. So, you know, it's going to vary. College towns are different from the city of Chicago, as an example.
Yeah. All right, well, Kevin, because we're going to talk about the Buffalo Stadium.
Yes, so yeah, that's where I was going. I'm sure there's going to be all kinds of fun taxes on everything around Buffalo Stadium for a very long time. But Mike will know more about this because it's closer to home with him. If we were talking about Southern football, I'd be the person to jump in on it. But Mike's been a lifelong Bills fan forever and ever and ever. I know it's a suffering fan base, and. You know, threats of moving to Toronto and other things that I've heard from Mike over the years, but now they're getting a stadium from the city, and then they're turning around and not treating their long-term fans very well. Am I summing that one up Mike? In a very subtle way?
Yeah. No, you've summed it up perfectly. I just want to preface this by saying that. When I first found out I was going to come out and talk about this and, you know, about personal seat licenses and everything else, I was fully prepared to, like, eviscerate the McCaskies as a guy
who lived
in Chicago for 20 years.
Oh, yeah.
But it turns out the McCaskies weren't the first ownership group to do PSLs. It was actually the old owners of the Panthers before Tepper came along in the 90s were the first one to sell PSLs. The McCaskies just made a bigger deal out of it.
Well, Mike, would you mind if I put a little bit of a preamble on this?
No, go for it, Chief.
The preamble is, we've been talking about this on the show, you know, since whatever, years ago. And I dug up a whole bunch of stuff. And people wrote articles about stadiums and whether they were worth it or not. And one of the best articles is written by a lady from Salt Lake City. And this is, you know, this is 10, 15 years ago. And she talked about, evidently unbeknownst to us, since they don't have a football team, they have actually backed a few stadiums. I don't know if the Jazz was one of them, but there's a AAA team and there was a junior hockey team, but there were several of them. And she went through the nuts and bolts on virtually all of them. Everyone was a loser. And if you look here in Chicago, the soccer stadium, a loser. The new owner, I think, threw him a bone, so he got out of the lease somehow. But now we're going to have the Soldier Field. I think they owe more. Then the rent was $6.5 million. Come on, it's a pimple on the ass of an elephant. And the Soldier Field owes as much now as when they built the place. Sox Park, 20 years, they still owe a bunch of money. Every single one of these things, the Railcats in Gary, a stone cold loser, every single one is right there a loser for even the dumbest in our population to read, and yet every time they manage to pull it off. It's amazing to me. I have a client who's there's a big Jewish community up in Minnesota, right? And he's from that group. And he claims that the mayor, when he let the North Stars go to Dallas, where they became the Stars, right? How stupid of a move that was, because he could have kept them for $5 million or $10 million or something. And then the hue and cry was so bad that to get the new team was like $100 million. So what a horrible deal it was. Because they could have pissed away 20 instead of 100. I mean, that's kind of the only rational positive I've seen, and even that's not so rational. How do we keep doing it, I guess, is the question.
It's funny you mentioned Minnesota. I'm actually married to a lovely woman from Minnesota who obviously grew up a huge North Stars fan, and to this day is still bitter about the decisions that were made that sent the North Stars to Dallas. I mean, they were such an integral part of the community for so long. I mean, you know, Minnesota is the most, it's practically Canada as far as how hockey mad the population is. And, you know, the Wild are not not an acceptable substitute. And the whole thing was just handled so
poorly. Would you rather be Chicago mayor that pissed away half $1 billion on a private franchise, or the mayor that let the Bears go?
That's a really, you know, it's like rock in a hard place.
Yeah,
that's a really good question.
I always liked how Daly kind of messed with the Bears, saying that, well, you know, Chicago's big enough to support two NFL teams. Why don't we go get ourselves an AFC team?
I don't.
Daly used to say that. I always really liked when he would say that. You know, we'll get an AFC team. We'll put them out in Arlington Heights. You know, we could support two NFL teams. That's one of the things I always liked, that he used that line.
Well, he wouldn't let him use the Chicago Bears either, right?
Yeah. Do what?
He wouldn't let him use the name if they left the town.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. That, I remember that thread as well.
All right, so Mike, go ahead. What's going on with the Buffalo thing? I know they got $100 million from the state, didn't they? Somehow,
They got a little bit more. I think it's a couple $100 million from the state. They've got a bunch from Erie County, which, like most heavily populated counties in the U.S., is damn near bankrupt. And there's a whole kerfuffle around that as well, and around the.
No, is this for Erie County, sorry to interrupt. There's a million questions. Is this for infrastructure for the land, making the place, the water, the sewage, all that stuff for a state? Is that what they're paying for? Or are they actually paying for the building itself?
They're actually paying for the facility as well.
Okay.
So it's they've kicked in and kind of, you know, so that essentially the already strained taxpayers of Erie County are subsidizing the stadium. But the whole thing is, it's strange because, I mean, Bills fans would go to, if you look at like those third world soccer stadiums, like in some African countries, it was just nothing but an open field and a bunch of concrete bleachers. Bills fans would go sit in those to watch the Bills. But it's just, you know, the way the NFL has gotten with the requirements around luxury suites and premium seating capacity, all those types of things have just led to this need to build these. You know,
all right,
reading
between the lines is you're saying the old stadium is not so bad.
The old stadium is. It's not. It's definitely, like I said, it's definitely up to Bills fan standards. I was just there a couple of weeks ago, and for the Patriots debacle, and I'm amazed by how well it's held up. I mean, I remember going there as a kid. You know, my first Bills game was 1982. It was built in 1973.
Okay,
so it's 52 years old. My first game there was in the early 80s when I think Vince Ferragamo was still the quarterback, and or maybe it was Joe Ferguson. I can't remember, but. I just remember going there and being awed by how, oh, wow, this is amazing. This is so cool. It was my first NFL game in this massive stadium. And then, you know, going to a bunch of games as a kid, a few games when I was in college in Buffalo, and then didn't go to a Bills game for probably 20-plus years.
Have there been any major rehabs along the way or no?
They replaced a lot of the seats sometime in the late 90s, early 2000s. I can't remember exactly when.
But no kind of a massive thing where they added a gazillion skybox or anything like that?
No. They do have luxury boxes, but they were all kind of built using existing infrastructure. What happened was they closed off a lot of the concourses, got smaller because of the luxury boxes. And that's what I realized when I went back there in 2019. I was like, wow. This place isn't so great. It isn't so, you know, as grand as it seemed when I was a little kid. But still, you know, it serves the purpose. You know, they pack, you know, 70,000+ screaming members of Bills Mafia and their Zubas and their funny hats to...
At a pretty reasonable ticket price, I assume.
The face value for a Bills ticket actually isn't bad at all. It's among the lower price tickets in the NFL. But the problem is you got to buy them in the secondary market now because, thank you, Josh Allen, for making the team good. The demand for Bills tickets, especially this year, has been just through the charts. I bought my tickets through SeatGeek in the 300 level for the Sunday night game week before last, and to sit 7 or 8 rows up in the 300, it was $250 a pop. Well, now you think about that, probably.
And SeatGeek
is
what,
Josh Allen?
30 a piece for a ticket. That's cool too.
Yeah. No, it probably. Now,
do they pay? Who owns the place? Do the Bills pay rent, or the Bills own it?
The Bills own it, I believe.
Okay.
So it's own, you know, it comes with the team. So they've you know, the stadium is no longer, like I said, it's fit for Bills fans. It's not fit for the NFL. So if you think back to, you know, Russell kind of hinted at this earlier, you know, early to mid 2010s, when there were rumors that the Bills were going to move to Toronto, that Trump was going to buy them and move them to Vegas, or John Bon Jovi was going to buy them and move them to Toronto. They'd really been flirting with the Toronto idea for a few years. But the Pegulas came in kind of, 11th hour white knight and ended up keeping the team in Buffalo. But I guess the deal with the devil that they made is now that, the team's going to be in Buffalo and nobody's going to be able to afford to see them play.
So the current group does not have seat. Actually, Soldier Field has the seat light. Those things, if you want to, I looked up, some idiots still want like $20,000 a pop for what, 2 more years?
Yeah.
What manner of, whatever, there's going to be somebody who wants everything, but really?
It's, yeah, the whole Soldier Field thing is so, just, I so, mean, it was poorly handled from the beginning, I think.
Well, if you and I got the contract to clean the toilets, it was handled perfectly, right? We did well.
Yeah, exactly. It's true. Even though they went from troughs to urinals.
Yeah. So now the thing is up and running. Who the money is, how can you put a percentage on who's paying for what? And at the end of the day, the Bills are ownership, total owners?
So the Bills will own the stadium. I'm trying to think what the breakdown is. I think, I'm just quoting this top of mind, I think the Pegulas, the ownership group, are on the hook for $500 or $600 million. I think the county kicked in a couple hundred million. And I think the state, thanks to Governor Hochul, who one of the few things that she has going for is that she's a Bills fan. She's from only a couple miles away from where from Orchard Park, where the stadium is. I think the state kicked in close to $1 billion. So the cost is largely covered. But I think that in spite of the fact that Terry Pegula is worth he's an oil guy.
The state was a contribution, not a bond.
Right.
Oh my
Erie
God.
Erie County is going to have to sell bonds to make their to make up the shortcoming. And then
there's no payback from the Bills. It's not like they got to pay interest on the money. It's a gift to them.
Exactly. It was a nice present from the governor.
How do you handle that tax wise? Jesus.
That's a question for Russell.
Yeah.
I took one accounting class in a summer at community college, and even that was over my head. I have no idea how that works. So you've got the Pegulas on the Pegulas are obviously on the hook for a decent chunk, but in spite of the fact that he's worth $6 billion, he still wants to make his gift in kind back. So he's resorted to selling PSLs, and this is what's really broken a lot of Bills fans. I mean, you think about this fan base. This is Buffalo is a very working class town, and it's a very working class fan base. A lot of these members of Bills Mafia have had season tickets for generations. And they're getting squeezed. They're looking at $10,000-$12,000 just for their PSLs, and then the price of the ticket itself, the season tickets itself, is I think it's going up about 35% or 40%.
Well,
for the new
stadium. Think Russell and I and the rest of the people on the show. By the way, I'd like to have you add more than like once every few years. I don't think that guy, the new owner, has any clue of the state of the rest of the people in this country, nor does he care.
No, I don't think that's the case at all. I think it's a shame.
Go through all the numbers that Russell and I go through every week. You name me somebody that can write an $80,000 check so we can buy tickets for the next 10 years. I mean, where is that guy?
I can tell you that it's certainly not the firemen and the policemen that I was tailgating with in one of the private tailgating lots a couple of weeks ago. I mean, these guys are really feeling the squeeze. My daughter lives up there, and her boyfriend, actually, he has a pretty good job. He works for FedEx. He works in treasury risk management for them. And even he is concerned about being able to afford his PSLs. And, a lot of his friends, these aforementioned firemen and cops are not going to be able to afford to pay that either. So it's really, it's going to be a struggle.
You're going to end up with people doing, everybody's going to go in on a seat license if they're really that crazed so they can do their tailgating. The weird part when the Bears sold them is they gave no preference to how long he'd had a seat.
Nope.
My cousin, who just had his 90th birthday, coming up to 91, he had season tickets at Wrigley. And then when he, in the old Soldier Field, God, he was there since day one. I think he was 10th row, 50 yard line. And when he won the seat thing, he got shut out. So he's with the great unwashed on the one side without the seat.
Yeah, no, we had Bears tickets for a few years that we bought three. Actually, we bought the whole season from again, a longtime season ticket holder, but we were in the north end zone, 300 levels, so same thing, no PSLs, but the seats weren't great, let's put it that way, but the atmosphere sure was.
And the one side with the great unwashed, you go in and out a different exit and entrance. You don't even mix with the washed.
Yeah, exactly. That,
it's so bizarre.
It's called now, but it used to be that. I remember back in the day, it was the Cadillac Club. I think it might be the United Club now.
Yeah.
But they had, that was the big thing, was they had their own separate entrance, and they didn't have to deal with the great unwashed in there.
Because his seats now, they're above the columns of the old Soldier Field. That's how far up he is. His seats suck. Anyway, go ahead. So they're going to, now the people who have season tickets, they're going to get a chance to buy these things. The $20,000 is all the price, or depending on where you are, it's more or less?
I think it's between 10 and 13 grand per ticket. So you're looking at probably, minimum $20,000 for two, regardless. And obviously that goes up if you've got seats on the, seats in the lower bowl, closer to the middle of the field. But it's, of these folks that I've talked to, I have yet to find one who's actually bought their PSL. So I don't know who's buying them. I mean, the team says that over half of season ticket holders have committed to the PSLs, but they're being really squirrely about the exact number. Obviously, they're putting the PR spin on it and trying to make it look like there's demand, but I don't know how close they're going to come to being able to sell these.
What's the is there going to be this massive club, or if you want to go in and have breakfast, it's $100, and how many skyboxes are they talking? Dallas has 325 skyboxes.
Yeah. I don't think the new stadium's anywhere on par with that. But there's only a couple dozen right now. They have them around the entire. I'm picturing it right now. They have them kind of around the entire lower ring of the stadium. They've got luxury boxes, and then one side has maybe 10 or 12 along one of the. I think it's the Bills side of the field has a.
Have you ever hanging around Dallas? If you're there, I would recommend. Of course, I did this 10 years ago, and it was $17. But you got to get a tour of that place.
I do want to see it.
Oh God, it's. Are you guys going with the? If you look on the field, the first there's like they look like these little dugout things, and then there's the first four or five rows of seats. Are actually higher up than most stadiums, so you can actually see over the players, and like you ought to be able to everywhere, but you...
Right.
Those are skyboxes. Your spot where you can sit and drink and eat shrimp is below, but you get the first two or three rows of seats are yours. So you can either sit up there, or if you need a beer, you run downstairs and grab a couple of shrimp and a beer and you come back up. Hey, so those are considered skyboxes. Yeah. Those are considered skyboxes, even though they're low boxes.
Now, I think the Yankee Stadium has that as well. They have
really?
corporate seating along the first and third base sides that are they've got their own little separate entrance. They have individual each little unit, little box, if you will, has air conditioning built in, which is really nice for those humid New York days. And you go by there, and it's J.P. Morgan's got a bunch. Bloomberg has a couple.
How does Russell not invite us to these things?
I was going to say, yeah, you'd think a man of such academic connections and prestige would be able to...
Well, with the outfit...
Look, guys, I have work friends, and I have friends.
Well, you could say we are somebody. You could say we're big shots or something,
I'm a contributor to Chicago's favorite sports and finance-focused morning talk show.
Yeah, could you imagine Russell trying to put down on a card who we were and why we deserve to go into the skybox? What would he say?
Long-suffering fan.
There's no way we could bring Kevin. I mean, there's no way you could stretch it.
No.
Well, Russell, what do you make of all that? How does the tax laws and how does this all, like, because it follows right on with our Big Ten conversation earlier. If people are going to take a part of these things, when do they become taxable? When do they leave the school for sure and become just a sponsored pro team? When does... How does all this work?
Well, that's kind of what's going on with the Big Ten right now, with them in discussion. They're in discussions with taking on an equity partner, and it keeps being reported as private equity, and it's actually not private equity. It's the University of California retirement system that's got, which is kind of funny because UCLA is actually a Big Ten school, but. The Big Ten is having to do this because they're not able to keep up revenue wise with what some of the new costs associated with running a college football team. Well, yeah, that really the Big Ten is having to do that, and we're not talking about my the American Athletic Conference where my school plays.
Well, maybe if you didn't pay coaches $50 million to leave, your cost wouldn't get so much.
No, huh? I agree with you, but they agreed to that. They agreed to that with him before they realized that they were going to have to start coughing up $10 or $20 million bucks a year for players too. And more power to him. Anybody that can screw over Penn State in any way, shape, or form is a good guy by me. They shouldn't even be allowed to have a football program after the crap that happened there.
Well, my LSU buddy is hoping that they take Kelly from them. The exact words were, "I'll pay for his ticket if you get him the hell out of our place."
I'm even growing up in Memphis. I was the northern person in the Rhodes family, and the majority of the Rhodes family went to LSU. So, band members, all kinds of they're diehard. Even the ones that didn't go to college at all are diehard LSU fans as well. And they hate that guy.
Well, you know,
they just had never been real thrilled.
Is LSU Audrey, talk about it off topic. Audrey used to design, she's a drum corps person. She did that her whole life, right? So, So for a while, she actually designed halftime shows for colleges.
That's fun.
And she was down at one of these Louisiana schools, and they do all the drawing, something, then they go out to this bar. And she was staying, one of the dorms or something. And the guy gives her, I don't know if it was LSU or Louisiana State, somebody down there, by the swamp. and the guy goes, well, here's a flashlight. Her walk was like a quarter mile back to the dorm. She goes, what do I need that for? He says, well, keep it on the sidewalk in case you see an alligator, you'll chase him back into the swamp. And she goes, an alligator? To say she never went back there. she made it back to the dorm, but that was it. She was out of there the next day. She goes, give me a flashlight to chase the alligator. It might be on the sidewalk while I'm walking back. It was one of the Louisiana schools. I don't know which one it was, but she goes, I'm not going back there. Just saying.
And I thought the skunks and raccoons that I used to see walking home in suburban Chicago were bad, but that takes a whole different dimension.
So, at the end of the day, what if they don't sell them? I mean, what's the? It seems like there's a lot of balls in the air for a thing that's almost done.
Yeah, I mean, this thing's going to open in less than a year.
So it's next
season.
I don't know
what they're going to end up doing. Do they? I don't think they're going to cave in as far as the business model. I don't think they're going to cave in on the price, and I think there's just going to be a shortfall. And I'm hoping that it doesn't affect the abilities team to. I hope it doesn't affect the team's ability to continue to put a decent product on the field. I wouldn't exactly say high quality. We still can't get past the Chiefs in the playoffs, but I hope it doesn't affect the long term performance on the field. And I certainly hope it doesn't affect the viability of keeping the Bills in Buffalo.
Are the skyboxes they all full?
I'm not sure.
I wander off topic all the time, but when they built the stadium in Washington, and
FedEx, where the Commanders play.
Well, no, baseball.
Oh, the Nats Park, which is supposed to be great. I haven't been there yet. It's a shame because I'm a big baseball guy.
It's marginal. I went there for a couple games. In the back, it goes up so high; it's like five decks. I sat up on top; I couldn't see anything. The next night, I got a seat way lower, but I'm sitting. I know when it was built because we were talking about it. God, John and I were on the score way back then, and the fight for the skyboxes among the lobbyists and law firms—it almost got hand to hand, right? Because you had to have one.
To have one, and it's got to be the best one.
You got to be the best one, and also the seats down on the bottom. You had to have those too. If you didn't have a skybox, you'd have four right by home plate. So I get these tickets one night. I go, just back when you could go out in front and buy a ticket, which I did. And I'm sitting, just to the left, right behind the dugout, the 12th row, which are pretty damn good. But those were just outside where the real cool seats were, right? So I never saw, let's just say, scenery in my life like I saw there. And every the people that say how many women must work in Washington... Well, evidently all these guys did was give all their tickets because they didn't want to go. They just had to have them. They'd all give them. I'm sitting there going, and every three innings, ladies are walking up and down the aisle, and I'm going, they either got weak bladder or they want to be seen or are drinking a lot of beer, one or the other. It was a show like I never saw. And then all of a sudden
doing
now...
They're for Instagram. They got to get those good seats. Yeah.
But now here it is.
All these young lobbyists and congressional aides.
Well, then the Cubs played out there this year, and I'm watching the game. Those seats are all empty. All of a sudden now is the bloom gone off the rose or what? There's nobody in them. There's nobody there. I mean,
that's Major League Baseball across the board. I think attendance was only up like 1% this year.
Yep.
And if you go beyond a half a dozen teams or so, it's like that everywhere. Yeah, everybody in Chicago, gripes about Mike and I's team, the White Sox, and the lack of attendance, et cetera. Well, the White Sox are like, they're kind of mid-tier as far as attendance goes.
I think they're 18th.
It's not like they're at Destabot. Yeah, I always feel like they're in the middle third.
Yeah.
So kind of at the bottom of the middle third. But still, the Cubs are not – the Cub game experience is not normal for Major League Baseball. And if anything, the Major League Baseball experience is getting worse at a lot of – outside of a handful of stadiums.
Well, it's better in a sense that the games are half hour less than they used to be.
As I get older, I definitely appreciate that. Getting home,
my big thing, and I know I've said it a million times on this program, was 100 years ago the most popular sports in America were boxing, horse racing, and baseball,
bowling.
And I'll tell you now that basketball and football are ahead of baseball.
Yeah,
I saw a guy tweet when the NBA finals came to an end. He was like, football doesn't start until, August, and hockey doesn't start until September. I don't know what I'm going to do with myself now.
Well,
the NBA season came to an end, and there was just nothing, in his mind, there was nothing going on sports-wise until the NFL kicked off.
Well, Mike, I want your opinion. You sound like much more of a blue-collar kind of guy than the rest of the people on the show that do nothing but call me a Luddite. I honestly think that not giving people paper tickets is causing a lot of this drop.
I think that's part of it. I remember in my I worked on the floor of the Board of Trade early on in my career.
Hey, good for you.
And they got a whole bunch of stories about that. We can do a whole episode on my Board of Trade story sometime, Chief. But I remember one of the big things was you gave a broker a lot of orders, and they'd walk over to you after the game or after the bell and hand you Cubs tickets.
Yeah.
And I think there's something cool about actually being handed paper tickets. I still have a jar, and I stole this idea from our friend Dr. Rhodes here. The ticket jar. I have this giant jar of ticket stubs on my desk right in front of me, going back to Cubs and Sox games in the early 90s when I first moved to Chicago, and going back to Rochester Red Wings games when I was growing up in Rochester in the 80s. And there's something about that, about having that paper ticket.
Well,
I think just adds it's nostalgic, obviously, but I also think it's more appealing to go to something when you actually have a ticket in your hand.
We have Russell and I have a mutual friend, Sox tickets forever. In the last 3 years, he paid them $500 extra to have tickets printed, and now they won't do it, and he said, I don't want them. The guy gives away, he maybe goes to 10 games, so he gives away 70 of them.
Mm-hmm.
He goes, every night, I don't want to get a phone call from somebody. I'm thinking, I'm not happily married, I'm happily girlfriended, but I really don't want 50 phone numbers of smoking hot young ladies, number on my phone where I went and gave them the ticket, I had to give them the ticket on the phone. I just want to hand it to you. St. Louis has gone from, one of the listeners sent me an article from St. Louis. Some guy, and you guys know how to do this, but you have to go. You have to take the days like a rainout date where nobody's there, when you can count 15 people in the place. The number that you get that day, because they give you the tickets sold, that's your full season tickets plus any kind of packages. Well, of course, if it's a rainout date on Tuesday afternoon, there's not going to be any packages for that game. So you can get some sort of an idea of how many. And he thinks St. Louis has gone from 31,000 to 18,000 in 3 years.
I think there's something there.
I wouldn't want to be, as much as I used to love going to Cub games, if I wanted to be a season ticket holder, I'm going to give away 60 games. I don't want to screw around with SeatGeek or some other thing 60 times for the rest of the seats. Why would
no.
I?
No, we had to deal with that. We've already had to deal with that a couple of times for Purdue games where we went down there and they had that huge weather delay, and we decided to come back. And a couple of my daughter's friends at Purdue had not been able to get tickets to that game, and they're like, "Well, we spent 20 minutes trying." And I say it was actually Mary Beth and my daughter. They were trying to figure out how to transfer the tickets within the internal Purdue system to other students. And it's like you said, you got to add them as a contact and all this other kind of stuff. And there is something about those physical tickets. A million years ago, I used to go to Boston for this thing called the Head of the Charles in the Fall. And believe it or not, the people that are lifelong Red Sox fans used to get their tickets in late October for the next year.
Really?
Like in the big sheets. And this guy, the guy had gotten them, who I was staying with had gotten them, and he was breaking them up. And, you know, that goofy movie with Jimmy Fallon where everybody's bidding on the tickets and everything, it was almost like that experience. But, you know, that now what happens to, does all of a sudden something pop on your phone? It's just not quite as an exciting experience as it used to be as
a fan. Plus, you can put one of those little holograms on the ticket where, if they're stolen, they can make sure they're not good. It's not like they can't.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's go to a quick break here. We got to talk a second about Micah. When we come back, I want to talk more about this, but what's the fallback position if they don't sell out? Then what? I mean, SP Futures up 48, NASDAQ Futures up 234. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are or what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Are you one of the millions of people who suffer with pain? Do you wake up in the morning with stiffness in the lower back or neck? Why are you using medication to cover up the symptoms without treating the actual cause? Painkillers, muscle relaxants, and anti-inflammatories are not the answer. At ChiroMed, physicians are trained to detect the cause of your symptoms and to correct the underlying problem. If you're ready to listen to common sense and do what it takes to make changes in your body that can affect your health for the rest of your life, give ChiroMed a call and set up a complimentary consultation. They are located in Orland Park and can be reached at 708-403-2727. 20,000 patients over 22 years have been treated at ChiroMed, and over 90% of them have had positive results without medication or expensive surgery. Isn't it time you did something good for your body too? Give ChiroMed a call. 708-403-2727. That's 708-403-2727. Let's get you pain-free and living again.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Allender on the board. SP Futures up 46. NASDAQ Futures up 227. We're basically up the same amount we were down yesterday after the cooking oil announcement out of the White House, which was somewhat bizarre. They're not buying our soybeans, so we're not going to buy cooking oil because we can make it here ourselves. I guess we can make it with the soybeans they're not buying, just saying. Over in Europe, we've got DAX up 21, call that flat. FTSE down 29.3%. CAC Iran, however, is up 188, 2.4%. Evidently, luxury brands drive gains in France, whatever those happen to be. Asia, Nikkei up 825, that's 1.7%. Hang Seng up 469, 1.8%. Shanghai up 46, 1.2%. So they had the big declines on the renewed trade deal. Now they're bouncing back up. This is really a... Boy, if you're a long premium, you're having a field day the last few days, but not many people are. U.S. 10-year, 4.02. The Bund, 2.58, kind of both unchanged. Oil, up 47 cents, but still under 60 bucks, 59.17. There's gas in Chicago now, under 3 bucks if you look for it. Brent, up 35 cents, 62.74. Gold, continuing to go up, up 34 bucks, 41.97, almost 4,200. Silver up 61 cents, 51.23. We're still long it. I don't know how much longer I'm going to stay long it, but we're long it. The U.S. dollar, 116.23 against the euro. So it's down a little bit. It was down under 116. It was over 117 a few weeks ago. We're going to have Russell opine on what 1% moves, 1.5% moves in currencies is it makes the stock market moves pale in comparison. The British pound, 1.34. It was over 1.35. Actually, it's 1.35. It was a point and a half higher a couple weeks ago. Crypto, which has been taking a hit, down another 1,200 bucks. 111, 650. It was over. It made it to 125. So it's down, you know, quite a bit from there, but still pretty high. Andrew, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports. Traffic sucked. Truck versus wall.
Yeah. I saw a picture of it earlier, and it is not looking great. But it is 7:38 here in Chicago on Wednesday, October 15th. Starting off with just a little bit of sports here, the Dodgers won over the Brewers last night, 5-1, taking their lead to 2-0 in the series. To Chicago weather, it is currently 57 degrees, going to be a little bit rainy throughout the morning. We're going to have a high of 61 throughout the day, and a little bit of sunshine, hopefully, in the later half. Then over in Phoenix weather, they are currently at 66 degrees. They are cool with plenty of sunshine. They're going to have a high of 80. And yeah, just as mentioned, the Chicago traffic is looking really bad today. Nearly every inch of the inbound Kennedy is going to be full of delays. And yeah, as we mentioned in our first half, right now it's just listed as a slow ramp to inbound Dan Ryan. That's where the accident was earlier. But when it was first listed, sorry, that's at the Stevenson South for I-94. Do I have the right thing here? Yeah, no.
Well, yeah, Stevenson had a problem too, so it was all over the place.
Yeah, okay. Looks like the accident we were looking at is removed from the site here. But yeah, that semi had totally collided where the, what would you call it, you know, kind of like merges off. Like, I don't know.
It forgot to merge and hit the wall.
Yeah, wasn't a good sight. So, traffic's not great on nearly every inbound expressway, but that's all I got. Back to you.
So, Russell, we get the market doing what it's doing. Gold's going up, and I will ask this question of you. If you're sitting across from me and I dump $2 million on your lap, what do you do with it today?
Oh, I put it in. You're not going to like what I say.
Well, I'm glad.
No. I think I would lean toward maybe 20 or 30 year bonds.
20 or 30.
Yeah, and the reason being is when you look at the yield curve right now, the two and the three year bond that's like the lowest yield to maturity right now. So if you're trying to play interest rates dropping, you know, near dated bonds aren't going to work very well. But I do think that longer dated bonds are the yield to maturity on them will come down a bit as they continue to have to cut rates to spur the economy. So I would focus farther, and that's not where. And I'm always trying to look where I don't think everybody else is looking. But I would be very comfortable in a space like that, and then. You know, if we get some sort of market sell-off, plan on shifting it over to stocks.
That's
exactly what I would do if somebody gave me a big stack of cash.
Here's the flip side of that argument, and this is this may be in a an old guy talking that walked through the 60s and 70s fiasco.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to say that the somehow or another in the last 20 years, make it more the last 8 or 9, we've had this big inflation issue. And somehow or another, the inflation numbers never made it into the long-term bonds. You were never able, you know, Grandma Rhodes was never able to walk down to the savings and loan and say, inflation's 12%. Oh, by the way, you guys are paying 15. That's a fair deal. It never got to that. I think that what the Fed is saying, and Powell to me looks like a beaten man. He's knuckling under, and Trump's going to put his daughter or somebody on the Fed, and they're just going to open the floodgates, which is perfect for Trump and his people, but it's not good for the rest of us. I don't see them growing the money supply 8, 9, 10% like it looks where they're headed. I don't see that not causing a massive inflation that will be reflected in a 10 or 12% long bond rate. Somewhere along the line, the market has to stop giving people money for less than the inflation rate. And I don't think they're going to get away with it much longer. That doesn't mean tomorrow or next week. I mean, I'm always early. I don't see, if we go back to a legitimate inflation rate of 5 or 6%, how the long-term rates are 8.5 or 9. I don't. They've gotten away with it this far, but I don't see how. People are just not that stupid, I don't think, over the long term. So I agree with you that if they went back to a normal sort of money supply growth, 2.5%, I think the long bond rates here are probably an okay buy. But before Russell, before there were even S&Ps, I was trading on the CBOE floor. You watch the bonds were essentially your S&Ps when the inflation was that low. There is a bond, a 30-year bond, and we used to get this manually every month. I used to get a big, because I had a board of trade badge, I get a big stack of papers of all the different bonds you can deliver. So the bond in those days, Russell, was a 8.5% 30-year bond. Now, if you want to deliver something a little different, you had to deliver 101% or 99%. You could deliver other stuff, but there was a factor to it. Guess where that thing traded? The low tick on the 8.5% bond.
Fifties?
Yeah, 66.
Okay, about a third below it.
So it was the long term rate. The 30-year rate got to like 12.5. The long-term rate never got to like 15.5 because people always thought somewhere along the line somebody was going to solve the problem, right? But can you imagine that? And I can't begin to try and make, if I get a client, a lot of my clients are pouring out of 401ks into IRAs here.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way I could buy something from somebody at 100 if I think there's somewhat of a chance, you know, even if I'm early or whatever, that 2 years from now, when the person's 74 years old, his bond's trading 80. I mean, I know if he lives 30 years, which is a tough call when you're 70 to start with, if he lives 30 years, he's going to get his money back. But nobody wants to see that at 80 on your sheets for 20 years before it starts to go back up. Do you think that we can go, because I think you feel the inflation's coming, do you think we can go with a inflation rate of 6 and 6.5% for the next 5 years and not have these long bonds reflect it?
I just don't think it'll stick at that level for that long. I think we'll have another bout with it maybe, but I'm starting to doubt that more and more. But I just feel like that focusing at a much longer end of the curve there is probably a safe thing to do. You know, also when you talk about them putting money into the system, what are they buying? They're buying longer dated bonds. Well, so I almost feel like there's like this artificial demand that will help maintain those things.
Well,
I agree with it or anything else. I'm just saying that's the reality of what seems to be going on in the world.
Well, you Hal was on yesterday, and he's got his, you get this stuff from Hal. where he's.
I do get this stuff from Powell.
He's talking about 11% money supply growth, the way it's going now over the next year. How is that not stagflation? I mean, how can they possibly not have it?
Well, if that's if that's what we actually end up getting, that is that definitely would be representative of that. But again, the one of the main ways that they increase the money supply is by buying back some of that longer term debt. So I just feel like there's an artificial demand from the Fed for those securities, and I would just be very safe being in them.
I understand.
$2 million, and
and
it was a dynamic response. And I also said that I would do that. You also have to take my age into account. I'm 58.
Yeah,
I'm probably going to teach until I'm 70. So I do have, a 13-year outlook or whatever. Plus, one of the cool things about being a college professor is, I can dodder around until I'm 85 and talk about how we should have put goldfish in the water tank to make things interesting around there again and be that old guy. You know what I'm saying? One of the great things about the academic space is that you really can, you have things to contribute. I have things to contribute when I'm 10, 15 years from now with respect to all the history of the markets that I've been able to witness. And it's kind of good to have me around.
You're going to outlive Sister Jean and still be doing stuff at 107.
My father used to say that he was going to end up. He hated the house that we lived in, but he really just never did anything about it. And he said, my wife would talk to him about moving, et cetera. And he goes, I'm going out of this house feet first. He went out of that house feet first. And I think that's probably what's going to happen to me, is I'm going to end up being in the classroom or something like that and having some sort of health incident, and that's what's going to make me stop working.
Well,
but that's the way I am, and that's the way you are. It's
not work if you love what you do.
Exactly. So, and I do love what I do. So but the point behind what I was just saying was, I have time on my side with respect to that. I think I would be okay with that. But also, you've got to assume, if we did get some sort of stock market correction, that there's going to be an instant assumption that the Fed's going to cut rates to help us out, and that is going to help me on the bond side when I flip around into stocks.
Well, the I know that I'm more on this because I, unfortunately or fortunately, got my ass stuck 2 years at the University of Chicago in a monetarist school. The idea that the Fed cut rates, what the Fed can do is add money into the system, which lowers the cost of borrowing bank to bank, or really anywhere, that night.
Yeah.
Okay, but I think if these guys drop these rates more, you're going to see what we haven't seen in a long time, and I thought we'd never see again. You're going to see the short-term rates go down, and then the long-term rates are going to go up.
You think so?
Yeah.
See, I think they're already kind of elevated. The only part of the curve that I think is really pricing in what our expectations are the next is just 2 to 3 years out. Also, I got to look at time because I might run out of time on this one.
You got 10 minutes.
I wasn't sure. Yeah. I lose track of time. So one of the things that's going on that you can see in the markets right now is this ridiculous uncertainty with respect to what the Fed's going to do after the December meeting. And it's showing up in an elevated December VIX level, but it's also showing up in... we expect there's 100% chance we're going to get a cut at the late October meeting. There's 100% chance we're going to get a cut in December. And then the next meeting, which I think is January, it's 50%. And the meeting after that is 50%. And I feel like there's this huge overhang with respect to Fed policy after December, because December is Powell's last meeting. And we just don't, and I, I, there's this big uncertainty overhanging everything right
well,
now
we would be,
with respect to that.
The uncertainty is who's going to be Tweedledum or Tweedledee is going to get the spot.
Yeah, who's going to be in there, and are they going to, you know, do what people believe is Trump's bidding and take rates down to 1%, and, you know, et cetera, or whatever. But, you know, that's really, there's so much blind uncertainty right now beyond December.
I don't think it's all that uncertain. I think that's what's going to happen. And I think the guys, it's going to be just like Hunt for Red October. You arrogant ass, you killed us.
See, the thing, you know, you would think if the market believed that Trump was going to get his guy in there and they were going to, you know, slash rates, that you would be seeing there's huge opportunity then to take advantage of thinking that the cuts are going to continue into early next year, because that's not what's being priced in.
Well, Russell, the classical formula for interest rates that we haven't seen work for 40 years, so it's one hell of a formula, but it makes essentially perfect sense. All right, the classical interest rate formula, for those that don't know, and Russell knows it, you know, back of his hand, it's your nominal rate is equal to the real rate of interest. By the way, if you borrow money from somebody, it's just like buying concrete or steel. It's a factor of production. You have to pay somebody for their capital, because you need it and they have it, something you have to pay for. I mean, this is a novel concept to most people, but it isn't. So there's a real rate of interest. Russell lends me $1,000 to build a new office for PTI that we're going to make money on because we have more people in there. Guess what? I got to pay Russell for $1,000. Why should he give it to me for free? It's his $1,000, right? It's just like buying a new desk. Okay, so there's the real rate of interest, and then we have to sit there and go, okay, if I have to pay you back in a year, and the inflation rate's 5%, well, I got to make that up to you too, right? So if we're going to say the real rate of interest is 3 and the inflation is 5, I better give you 8% so we're both even, correct?
Yeah.
This particular formula...
Inflation is supposed to be the biggest, the biggest factor impacting interest rates,
but for years
anticipated inflation.
But how many years
we forgot about it?
but how many people, even when we had the 10% inflation during COVID, how many people had their money in a bank making 1% or 2%? They were losing 8% a year on value, and somehow we've managed to not even realize that this formula is still kind of lurking out there. We might actually come back to it someday. I mean, how long are people going? Why would somebody give a bank their money at 1% when the inflation rate is 8%. You just gave the bank 7%, for God's sake.
Yeah.
And yet we're still doing it. And really, it's in your mindset. And you know what, Russell? It's in mine, too. That maybe going forward, this is never going to match up. And you ask yourself, how the hell did that ever happen? How did the market ever be that screwed up? Theoretically, and I think I can tell you how, the only way it was that screwed up, when the interest rates got to 1% and then the long-term rates got to 1.5%, it was the, out of maybe buying the market in 1981 when I started, it was the single easiest, most obvious trade I've ever seen. Yet, try and do it. We must have been short bonds 15 times, and I think we barely squeaked the positive. When I say we, me and my clients, that we do the stuff that I do for them, because I never dreamed ever in my lifetime, Milton Friedman, if he was alive, that the Fed would buy, $5 trillion worth of stuff, just so that didn't happen. That, I don't think...
Yeah, I mean...
Go ahead.
Japan was doing that forever before we were, and I think we looked at them and we're like, well, we'd never, end up like that, and it's kind of interesting that we have.
What do you think? If you probably could snoop and do this, because you got all that... Not saying that people in Indiana are snoops, but people that are professors have access to information. What do you suppose the inventory is of the European Central Bank? What do you think that cesspool looks like? Buying stuff at negative interest rates for 3 years.
Oh, it's they're they're basically just moved money from one place to another.
I mean, they bought Pioneer.
It's more of a, you say it's a shell game. You say it's successful. I think more of like just being a shell game where they, you know, just took some nasty paper off the street and gave money to people that turned around and bought other similar assets.
They
didn't make the situation any better.
Well, they had to pay, if the coupon on the bond was 3.5% or 4, mm-hmm. in order to get it, negative, they would have had to pay what, 140, 138,
yeah,
somewhere?
Yeah, well, they would pay, yeah, they'd pay a premium for the
bond. So now mm-hmm. that their interest rates have actually gone back up, what do you think it's trading for, 80, 90?
Probably so, yeah, well below par.
They got to be.
One of the things with the central banks is supposedly they, and this was the whole idea behind the TARP stuff back in, you know, 2008, 2009, is they have the ability to, you know, weather a very long storm, and they can buy this paper and eventually it will, you know, mature off the books.
Well, it'll mature at 100, not 140.
Yeah, and it'll mature at, you know, at 100, not 140. But the central bank can deal with that as well. You know, the problem is when they start to skew the regular markets and skew the natural, you know, the natural supply demand of the overall markets.
Let me ask you.
I mean, half the reason that I'm talking about buying bonds, it's not based on a fundamental outlook for inflation or anything else. It's that I think over time, you know, they will, the longer dated bonds will start to appreciate price wise because rates will come down, because eventually they have to at that, you know, at that end. But I don't think they're going to allow them to, you know, because that's where I feel like a lot of the manipulation is going. Well, I shouldn't say manipulation, but where they buy a lot of things is, you know, focusing on longer dated.
Well, you and I, especially if it was 10 years ago, what you just said, I would have said is absolutely gospel. The mm-hmm. Fed cannot wait. They can do this. They can do that. Looking at the situation now in terms of government debt, even though we have a president who's clever enough to have just put through the biggest tax increase ever in the history of this country, and half of the people that support him don't even realize he did it with these tariffs. I mean, it's how scary is that on mm-hmm. our education system? I don't know that if the Fed has a balance sheet of $1 trillion, I think now we both realize they can probably go to 6 or 7. Can they really go to 15 or 20 if they need to? I don't know. I think we're reaching a point where the rubber band is pretty stretched. And even though I agree with mm-hmm. you, I don't know when you're taking in, you know, 60% of the money you're spending, I don't know if they have that. Don't worry, they can always absorb it forever. I don't know if they've got that in their arsenal anymore. I hope they do, but mm-hmm. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, they do if we experience an awful lot of inflation, because you really want to look at debt as a percentage of, you know, the overall economy. And if, you know, we've got all this debt outstanding and all of a sudden we, you know, experience, you know, a bout of inflation, that the outstanding debt becomes a smaller percentage of GDP, and that's how you end up with your depreciation of the currency as well. So I mean I feel like that's going to kind of continue to happen as a slow bleed.
Well, we have the I guess that's our last comment, and we'll talk next week. But the mantra is the new policy, the new fiscal policy. And you're much closer to this than I am. And this appeared, what, 20 years ago? As long as your GDP is growing at, you know, one-tenth of the smallest thing you can think of, greater than your debt, you're okay. And because somewhere you'll catch it. Yeah, we've had how many administrations in a row that have put through massive tax either cuts or spending increases with the promise that it's going to be accretive, and guess what? They never are. All they do is lie. So even if the theory makes some sort of sense, it ain't working out that way, is it?
No, it's not working out that way. You know, I really, if I had all the time in the world, if I hit the lotto today, I'd like to go through, you know, the Congressional Budget Office, which is supposed to be nonpartisan. does an analysis of new programs, et cetera. I would love to compare their projections to what things actually cost, et cetera, sometime.
Well, you know what? I think part of the problem just...
That should be a whole graduate seminar right
but,
there.
Last statement on that. If you talk to Carl will say one of the problems they have, one of the knives in their behind, is if the Congress says, okay, here's a plan, we're going to pay Russell $1 million a year for the next 5 years, and then we're going to stop paying him.
Mm-hmm.
The budget office, this is not whether they're politically corrupt or whether influenced. They, in their estimate, have to account for the fact that in 10 years they're going to stop paying you, because that's what it says.
Right.
But in essence...
How many government programs...
Yeah, in essence, they always get extended. So, you know, in a lot of ways, the way it's done means they're going to underestimate. But, I mean, what are you doing when you get a buffoon like Trump or Reagan that says, oh, by the way, we're going to have, this tax decrease for my buddies, essentially, whoever it happens to be, is going to be accretive because my buddies are going to make so much more money, we're going to end up on top of the game. Or a buffoon like Biden that says we're going to spend all this on infrastructure, but guess what? Everybody in Mississippi is going to have Wi-Fi, so the tax returns in Mississippi are going to quadruple. They're both flat-out lying to you, right? I don't think the Congressional Budget Office has a big sign in Washington that says, hey, our president's a buffoon, these numbers don't match up. They got to be influenced, right? I mean, there's no way they come out with that statement, is there?
No, I mean, everybody has, you know, a power overhanging them that they have to answer to, just about everybody. Even, you know, and even our president, to a certain point, has... That's why I say our president's not the most powerful man in the world, because there are a couple of guys that have big red buttons on their desks, like Trump says he has, that have easier access to their big red button.
So are you here, or did you go back down there, or are you still here?
I am here with a French bulldog laying on my chest right now, and I got to go back down tomorrow.
Now, when I leave Audrey's on the weekend, and the little Maggie, she looks at me, she gets all pissed off, and goes to the other room and goes to sleep. Now, when you go down to Indianapolis, does the French bulldog growl at you at the door and just be pissed off?
No, it's the beagle who actually gets really upset, and that's why I bought a house down there with a backyard so they could start coming with me.
Well, good for you. All right, bud. Yeah. I love seeing you the other day. I mean, obviously, Dr. Diniak is a breath of fresh air, for God's sake. She's terrific, mm-hmm. and maybe next week we'll have. Or these problems, we solve them every week. They seem to be getting worse.
Solve them, and then a week later, they seem to we should just rename this show the Whack-A-Mole Show. God. We whack one of them down, and another one just pops right up.
Oh, God. SP Futures up 49, NASDAQ Futures up 250. We'll see if that lasts. Back tomorrow, Stacks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.